Hello and welcome to today's episode of Ask Alan. And today we're joined by our SMSF coach, Olivia Long from Prime Financial. G'day, Olivia. Thanks for joining us again.
You're welcome, Alan. How are you?
I'm very well. Great. It's a bright sunny day here in Melbourne and you're, I think, a bit wintry in Adelaide, are you not?
Extremely wintry and blustery. So.
Well, we're going to get that tomorrow probably or the next day.
Absolutely.
That's what happens. Anyway, it's great to have you and we've got a bunch of excellent questions, of course, for you and for me. So we better get stuck into it. Remember, our answers are general advice and may not be appropriate for you. So please bear that in mind. And also just remember that if you've got any questions at all, put them on the Ask Alan section of the Eureka Report website. If they're for Olivia, she'll get to them in a month's time when she joins us once a month. And I'll get to them I'll get to them next week. So we got a few questions at the start about cryptocurrency. So let's get stuck into those, Olivia. You can read your first one out.
Absolutely, Alan. And look, the first question comes from a listener from last month's podcast, Jamie, who says, "Hello, Alan. In the interests of full disclosure, can Olivia confirm in regards to her SMSF clients who purchase crypto from her CoinTree referrals, if Olivia is receiving CoinTree tokens for these referrals also? Are Olivia's clients aware that while CoinTree upfront broker fees appear small, the CoinTree's buyers and sell prices are extreme? It could work out to be that the true commission that for CoinTree charges is around 3% for every single buy or sell." So firstly, Jamie, I should be so lucky. I received absolutely nothing for mentioning CoinTree, but I have referred your question to them and they responded saying that their rates are actually as low as 0.5%. and lower on coin trades, and they're keen to know where you get the 3%. So call me if you like, and I'll put you onto the appropriate person to.
I presume he's talking about the spread there, potentially. Maybe, I don't know.
So look, I'm no crypto expert, so I'll pass to you on that in a moment, Alan. But what we often see is SMSF clients that search for a cheaper exchange. But what they don't realise is that the cheaper ones are generally not appropriate to SMSFs because of the vigorous compliance requirements that are attached to an SMSF compared to, say, personal trading. So SMSFs generally need detailed reporting and tax tools, including having all of the transactional information in Aussie dollars. If you're sending through, say, a screenshot of transactions in US dollars, it's not appropriate for audit purposes. Not to mention, while you might be saving on trading costs, it actually becomes more expensive because your SMSF accountant's going to have to convert every single transaction from US dollars to Australian dollars and then account for any fluctuation in the currency, which is actually really time-consuming and costly and not only adds to your accounting costs but the costs of the audit. So as I mentioned, my disclaimer is my knowledge of crypto providers is limited. However, if you do have an SMSF and you're dealing in crypto, which is why I mentioned CoinTree just as one, is that you need to find a provider who not only has top-level security and can verify it to you, but has account managers or real people that can help make sure that you're setting up the SMSF in the compliant manner that it needs to be. And I see far too many that are non-complying. And they need to have the appropriate reporting tools to help prepare the financials and satisfy the independent audit. And another thing I just mentioned there, Alan, is that many people don't realise that any SMSF crypto needs to be stored on a separate wallet to any personal crypto. And that's probably the second largest mistake I see with people dealing in crypto in SMSFs.
Do many people use their SMSF to buy cryptos?
Huge number.
Right.
Yeah, and actually, and obviously the money that they've made, especially those who started investing early, is extreme. So,
right.
The ATO don't like it, and I can understand why, but from an investor's perspective, it's been, the paybacks have been significant. It's amazing.
We've got a couple of questions now for me from Hamish and Lee saying, where can I buy Bitcoins in Australia reliably? What's the best trading platform to use? Now, look, I'm not an expert on any of this. I presume CoinTree is one of them, Olivia,
yes.
You would say?
Caleb and Brown is another that I know of. But really, it's finding ones that are trading in that can report in Australian dollars because otherwise your accounting costs are just going to go through the roof. And I know people find it difficult even, making that conversion to US dollars and back. So It depends on the individual. Honestly, do your own research, in my opinion.
I did an interview this week with a bloke called Lasanka Pereira, who is the founder and operating officer of one Bitcoin or cryptocurrency exchange called Independent Reserve. So I talked to him a lot about various crypto topics, but I did ask him a few questions about how Independent Reserve operates and what their fees are. So listeners might want to just check that interview out as a possible provider.
Let's face it, Alan, one of the biggest risks with crypto is of the exchange getting hacked.
Yes.
And so when people are doing their research, how do you know, how viable, how robust is the infrastructure around the platform that you're actually using?
This bloke, Lasanka, said that premium customers of Independent Reserve have insurance that they pay for, but it's not available to everybody, just to what he calls premium.
Wow.
Which are big investors. But you can – so, therefore, you can get insurance via your provider, your exchange, to cover hacking, which I think, you know, particularly if you're investing a fair bit of money, would obviously be worthwhile, I would say.
Yes.
All right. Next question from you.
So that's for me, for Alex. He says, hi, I understand I'm able to salary sacrifice to provide additional contributions to my super fund. I've been trying to set that up, but payroll's taken much longer than expected, meaning I won't be able to reach the $25,000 cap. Next financial year, I'll set this up early and do a small amount each pay, but I'm trying to fill the gap this financial year. Is it possible legal to contribute to the cap from post-tax money and claim this as a tax deduction, for example, salary sacrifice after the fact? So, Alex.
What an excellent question.
Yeah, great question, and I'm getting it a lot at the moment. It is possible to make a concessional contribution from your personal money, but don't feel that there's any time pressure on doing it, because the contributional or concessional contribution rules have changed now, and any unused concessional contributions that you have in one financial year, you can actually bring forward and top up in the next financial year. So I'd suggest take your time, don't stress about it, and just use any unused concessional contributions in the 2022 financial year. So next question for me is from Graham. He says, my wife and I have an SMSF. My wife is starting a business with five other partners. Is it possible to use the SMSF to provide starting capital for the business? Another great question. Yes, it is possible on the surface, but it all depends on how the actual business is structured that you're setting up. It's actually a really complex area. It's something you can do. And if you'd like to give me a call, I'm happy to help you work through it, because we won't be able to cover it off on today.
So how do they give you a call, Olivia, without giving out your mobile number?
Fantastic. Please don't do that. If you call Prime Financial Group and ask for me, they'll pop you through. So easy as that.
Easy as that. There you are. Richard has a question for me, which is a bit long, but anyway, I think it's worth discussing. Alan, what are your thoughts on the new ETF from iShares called iShares Core MSCI Australia ESG Leaders ETF, ASX code IESG. I know you've discussed ESG type funds before, but at the risk of repeating stuff, can you please share your thoughts on this? On the surface, it looks like it might be a good thing to invest in, but one of the criteria about the index in the PDS confused me a lot. ESG controversies score. So he says the index uses the MSCI ESG controversies score to identify companies that are involved in serious controversies, and they're required to have an MSCI ESG controversy score of 3 or above to be eligible for inclusion in the index. So does this mean they have to be seriously controversial? Wouldn't a good ETF be better off investing in companies that are not controversial at all? Look, yeah, I agree. I mean, to be honest, I haven't read the PDS, Richard, so you'll have to excuse me, but I have looked at how the MSCI ESG index that is matched by this ETF is built. And I can't see a score. I mean, it just basically says, according to the MSCI paperwork on this, or the website at least, it says that anything on that list of controversial businesses is out. So, for example, here's the list: adult entertainment, alcohol, civilian firearms, controversial weapons, conventional weapons, fossil fuel extraction and reserves, gambling, nuclear power, nuclear weapons, oil sands, thermal coal power, and tobacco. Now, what it says, according to the index, is that they're just excluded. Any business in those things is excluded. So there's no discussion of a score. Now, maybe the PDS of the ETF adds something to that. I'm not sure, but I'd be surprised. I'd say that you're right. You know, I'd say you're right. I mean, if they're investing in those things at all, I wouldn't have a bar of the ETF, really. I'd find another way to invest in that MSCI index, if possible. You might want to follow up with the iShares. I think they're run by Blackstone or something. Anyway, might want to follow up with them and just ask them what's going on. Your turn, Olivia.
Okay, this next question has me fired up. John asks, my granddaughter has been working in London for 6 years now and has dual citizenship. She's purchased a house in the UK and is unlikely to return to Australia. Is she able to transfer her Australian superannuation to the UK? Now, I think it is, frankly, a huge flaw in our superannuation system that if you've previously been a permanent resident in Australia and you move overseas to live, the only country you can currently transfer your superannuation to is New Zealand. So sadly, the answer is no. Don't you think that's ridiculous, Alan?
I do. That's amazing. I didn't know that.
Yep.
I just had no idea.
Yep. You can work all your life, decide to retire to Italy, not be able to take your super with you unless you've satisfied a condition of release.
Right. And what sort of conditions of release are there?
Far too many. Age-based. And there's a number of them, Alan, so let's keep moving.
So it is possible but difficult, is that what you're saying?
Yes, possible but pretty well until you're ready to retire, until you reach retirement.
But, right, I see. So once you've retired, obviously you can cash it out.
Yes.
And take the cash with you.
Yep.
Right. Judith says, hi, Alan. Australian Unity Healthcare Property Trust appears under siege from Northwest, but there has been nothing in any of the expert columns about it and no views expressed as to the merits of the bid. Is it possible for someone to comment on this, please? Well, look, I don't know much about it. I agree with you. I can see that that's going on. Australian Unity Healthcare Property Trust owns some private hospitals and aged care properties, and this outfit called Northwest is making some takeover offers for it, and they're not happy about it. The trust directors are telling them to bugger off. But the only advice you are able to get, Judith, is from the directors of the trust at this stage, unfortunately, and I suspect that's the way it's going to stay. I might see if I can have a look at it for an interview or something. Maybe we can get the managing director or the chairman of the trust on to sort of undergo some grilling on the subject, but that's about the best I can do. Over to you, Olivia.
Okay, Fiona says, in 2018, I opened an Australian super account and made a non-concessional contribution of $250,000. I then went into pension phase on the 1st of July 2019 for the amount of $1.2 million in my SMSF. Since then, I've been adding $25,000 per annum to Australian super accumulation fund, and that's now worth $400,000. I'm 62 years and retired, but would still like to continue adding annual concessional contribution amounts to my super. Do I have to stop that now that my total super balance is now 1.6 million, or can I continue up to the new limit of 1.7 million? Now, Fiona, if your total super balance exceeds the total super balance cap for the relevant year, the only contributions you're eligible to make, you're right, are concessional contributions. So the
Do you mean non-concessional?
No, concessional.
Right, okay, go on.
Is concessional contributions. So the short answer is that, yes, you can continue to make concessional contributions up to the caps.
Up to 1.7?
No, up to the relevant concessional contribution caps for each year.
Oh, I see. Okay. Jesse says, hi, Alan. Seeing the only way for interest rates is to go up, wouldn't it be wise to avoid exposure to bonds like a plague, or am I missing some silver linings of this asset class? The only bonds I hold is in my super balanced fund. I'm seriously thinking about picking my own allocation so I can skip investing in bonds, but keeping the other asset class allocations in its current ratio. Yes, I completely agree. The only way that bond interest rates are going to go is up, which means their prices go down. The only thing I'd say is that I've been saying that for years now and it hasn't happened. So it's going to happen at some point, probably now. Certainly the market is saying that. So I do think that we're now we must be at the bottom of bond yields. So, yes, I think that excluding bonds from your portfolio is not a bad idea. What do you think, Olivia?
I tend to agree personally.
Yeah.
So Mark says, is it true to say that a person with an account-based pension would be better off to commute that account-based pension before taking a large lump sum and then restart the pension rather than just taking the lump sum without commuting it? I'm thinking about the impact on the transfer balance account, especially if the account has grown through earnings above the transfer balance cap. So in some circumstances, Mark, this is true. However, you are still required to meet the minimum pension requirements and commutations don't actually count towards this. The other thing to note is that any growth that you have in the pension account from income or capital gains doesn't impact on the transfer balance cap. So it might be advantageous to do a commutation if you have the ability to make further contributions because you are creating room in your transfer balance cap via the commutation, which will allow you to move future contributions into a tax-free environment. So that's a pretty good question there.
Jessie's looking for an interview with a superhero. I don't really have – she's asking if I've got any thoughts on this outfit called Superhero, which apparently has gives people more control over their super but is not an SMSF.
I can comment there, Alan.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Yeah, so Superhero, they're a cheap platform, but you don't actually have direct they're not direct holdings over shares. So basically they act as a custodian, and when you invest or buy and sell shares, they're the custodian of those assets. So SMSFs can't or generally don't use them because you don't have that direct control. So that's the only comment I've got that people have been surprised about when they've gone to trade on them versus, say, your Bell Direct or your other trading platforms that are cheaper.
So what's the point of using them?
I don't know.
They're obviously competitors to Prime Financial, right?
Competitors, Prime, Comsec, Bell Direct, you name it. They've come in with really low, cheap fees, but they're not what they present themselves to be isn't what actually you find out when you sort of look into it more deeply is the only comments that I've got there.
That's right. So it's not really an SMSF. It's not quite pooled. Is it pooled or is it?
It's custodian. So you could say, I can't explain it properly, Alan. I'll be honest.
Okay. Well, maybe I should interview the yes. person, whoever yep. it is, and inform people. So we'll get it on the list. Your turn.
Michael says, hi, Olivia. I have several times the $1.7 million tax-free limit in my SMSF. And have a question about making unlimited withdrawals once I turn 65. Do I have to establish a separate pension account or can I leave it all in accumulation and just take whatever I need? And look, assuming that there's nothing quirky in your fund's trust deed, then there is no requirement in general terms to establish a pension. Because once you turn 65, your super balance becomes fully unrestricted, non-preserved. So you have basically free access to do with your super as you wish.
So leave some in, take some out, whatever.
Yep.
This is just a question. Next one for me is just a question about the PEXA, forthcoming PEXA IPO. I don't know anything about it, but I'll put it on the list for an investigation or perhaps an interview. Your turn.
Okay. Adrian says, I've transferred some of my money into US dollars and have used most of the US dollars to purchase shares listed in the US that I plan on holding for more than 12 months. And obviously, I hope to make a capital gain. My question is, what happens in relation to capital gains tax when I make a profit on the share sale and then another profit when transferring the money back to Australian dollars if the Australian dollar is trading lower than when I originally bought the US dollars? Are there two capital gains tax events or just one? And actually, our tax specialist has said the interplay between foreign exchange gains and capital gains tax is fairly complex, but to answer it at a really high level, foreign currency can be regarded as an asset, and therefore there can be two capital gains tax events. So one on the disposal of the shares and the second on converting from the AUD to the USD.
Right. Well, that's nasty.
Or bad. Yeah.
Not good at all. Goodness. I suppose it doesn't matter in the sense that if it was only one event, it would be impacted by both the currency move and the asset price move. So even if it was one event, that would be yes. kind of combined, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Nick says, "Hi, Alan. This is not really a question, but I think it's worth airing, to be honest. I'm one of those unfortunate souls to be on a TFR, total fixed remuneration package, whose take-home pay will reduce on 1st of July with the government's mandated super guarantee increase from 9.5% to 10%. I've done some digging and it is entirely legal although immoral in my view. I won't say who I work for, but it's not Clayton Utes, who the Fin Review has just done an article on regarding the same issue. Yet another blow to any increase in real wages, and I think it stinks that so many businesses are passing on the SG increase to their employees, whose take-home pay will continue to fall as we head higher to 12%. Yes, well, look, it's true. Your take-home pay goes down and the amount of money going into super goes up. So it's not as if you're losing the money. It's being delayed. That's all I'd say. I mean,
yeah, look, I've had a lot of feedback on this, Alan, and a lot of people are impacted, including myself. So it does hit your pocket. And it is difficult. But the thing to note here is that employers don't get a choice as to whether or not they pass it on. They're forced to. So it's not up to your employer. It's the government who've made that change and that decision.
But they could give you a 0.5% pay rise.
They could give you a pay rise, though. That's the option that they've got to help cover off on the change. And I think, frankly, you know, most employees should be entitled to some sort of pay increase on a regular basis anyway. There's a lot to say on that.
Yeah. Next one's yours.
Melissa asks a great question and she said, "Hi, Alan and Olivia, love you both for all your wisdom." Thank you, Melissa. "Could you please explain to me the pros and cons in remaining individual trustees, hubby and self, or should we appoint a corporate trustee? My accountant is making a suggestion, so I'm assuming it has something to do with one of us dying and or losing the ability to run our own SMSF. I'm not that old, by the way, 65, and can you give me an idea of costs?" So I think your accountant is on exactly the right track. He's preparing you for, it will eventually become a single member fund at some point. But the corporate trustee structure is favoured by advisors and administrators everywhere, and I'll explain why. So the first example and first advantage is that you can have a single member fund, because if you remain with an individual trustee structure, as I said, one of you are going to pass away and you'll need to appoint a second individual as trustee. Now, appointing that role is not easy because acting as a trustee of an SMSF comes with great legal responsibility. And it can actually, we see it causes friction in families where one child is chosen over another. So you want to avoid that. The second benefit surrounds the risk of trustee litigation. So if there happen to be assets held by the SMSF in individual names and there's litigation against a fund, the trustees are actually liable, whereas companies have limited liability. Another example is that those that want to borrow within an SMSF need to have a corporate trustee structure. So for many SMSFs, why not set one up from the outset so that you have the flexibility to invest in that asset at one day if you decide to? And finally, for many years now, the ATO has been applying monetary penalties to trustees of SMSFs where there are certain breaches of the CIS Act. Now, if you have individual trustees, say you have four of them, then the breach is levied four times. Whereas if you have a corporate trustee, the levy can only be issued once, if that makes sense. But the main reason, and in my opinion, a corporate trustee is far easier, is from an administrative perspective. because it's far more fluid. So it enables multiple generations of a family to come and go. Parents can admit children into the fund. It's easy to add your spouse if you choose. It makes it easier for people in the event of divorce, because the fund can add and remove members without the need to change the name on the underlying assets, which can be difficult, for example, if you've got property, or it's even difficult if you have direct shares. It's time-consuming and it's painful. So I think even though you're only 65, it's going to be a time where you need it. So far better to do it while both trustees are still around to sign all the paperwork than to leave it to be handled once one person passes.
Excellent question and answer. Corey says, hi, Alan. I enjoy listening and reading as much as I can during the week in finance and money advice, which has led me to go back to uni and have a crack at a master's in finance. I thought that since so many students will not be back at uni and that the majority of study can be done online, it may be a good time to change profession. Just wondering what yourself and your financial gurus might recommend in studying reading or stroke reading if I was to lead into manage fund analysis. Any particular books or documents that might come to mind? Yeah, I thought I'd answer this because I'm sitting next to my bookshelf here.
Aren't we all?
And I just want to say, Corey, that I think the best thing to read is history of economics and finance and so on, because that's where you gain understanding most, in my view. So I've got beside me here Trevor Sykes' 3 books, The Bold Riders, 2 Centuries of Panic and 6 Months of Panic. So they're terrific books. He writes or has written about collapses and financial disasters and so on, which are always worth looking at. I've also got here John Kenneth Galbraith's small book called The Great Crash of 1929, which is a wonderful book, so beautifully written and informative. I've also got here J.K. Galbraith's The World Economy Since the Wars, which is interesting. David Landis's The Wealth and Poverty of Nations, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, fantastic book. What else? Benjamin Graham's The Intelligent Investor, and a few other similar kind of history books about economics and finance. So that's what I'd suggest you look at. And if those books I just mentioned are all terrific, worth reading.
Okay.
You got any ideas on books?
No, because I'm not into investments, Alan. Right, I'm just okay. The boring super expert, remember?
Yes. Okay, carry on. Your
Swift
turn.
Says, I have 2 super funds, both are in retirement phases, one being an SMSF and the other being an industry fund. So basically the SMSF trades shares and reinvests dividends while the industry super fund provides the day-to-day income. Does each super fund have to make the minimum pension payment, or can I make my combined minimum pension payments just from the industry super fund, which is a great question. But as each super fund is actually a separate legal entity and each pension minimum must actually be met, so you can't draw from just the industry fund, unfortunately.
Adrienne says, hi, Alan. I've been thinking a lot about Paul Clitheroe's assertion that time in the market is more important than market timing. I have a small amount of money to invest in the market, and with this in mind, I wondered what areas and what shares you feel are future-proof and able to keep growing for the next 20 years. Years ago, you advised us to buy BHP shares bit by bit for the future, but times are different now. Well, they are different, but BHP is not different, and it's still a terrific company. And in fact, in terms of good, safe, long-term investments, I reckon Australia's 3 biggest companies, BHP, Commonwealth Bank, and CSL, are pretty good. I mean, I'm not recommending them. I don't own them myself. I think that, that you could go do worse than that. I mean, I don't want to get into recommending too many or other particular stocks, but I do think that you're right. Paul Clitheroe is correct. It's all about time in the market. Market timing, the picking, that is to say picking tops and bottoms, is very difficult and almost impossible for most people.
I can probably say personally, Alan, time in the market for me has been extremely beneficial as well. And easy, much easier than the other. But look, Craig asks, can I set up a super account for my kids aged 9, 7, 5 and 3 and distribute it from a family trust? What should I consider? Firstly, well done for having 4 children. But look, you can set up a super account for your children, but making a payment to it directly from the family trust may not be possible. You're going to have to speak to your personal accountant about that. You can make non-concessional contributions on behalf of children. However, if you're going to set up children with super accounts, there are a few considerations, including who's going to act as a trustee for the accounts until they reach the age of 18 and who's going to be making those investment decisions over them.
It's also the case, isn't it, that if dad is the, or dad and mum are the trustees for those accounts, they are responsible for capital gains tax payments. Is that right?
I actually don't know that, Alan. I'm not a tax expert.
No, I think that's right. Anyway, that's certainly a thing you need to keep an eye on, Craig, as to what the implications, the tax implications of doing that would be for you and your wife. Ben says, Coles have a significant drop a few months ago, but climbing back. What do you think about Coles' current value? Is it time to invest? Look, I thought a couple of years ago that Coles was going to be in trouble because of Aldi and Costco, you know, taking away market share, really coming after it, and also the other German one, I can't remember the name of it now, the other German one was going to start up, and also Amazon and so on. So I think that I thought that the Coles and Woolies were going to be under siege and, you know, had the best days were behind them. I think I was wrong. I don't think the discounters have peaked, or it seems that they have not continued to, you know, erode Coles and Woolies market share, and those two businesses are doing okay. And they're certainly investing a lot of money now in online delivery, and I think they appear to be doing okay. So, look, I'm not an analyst. I haven't looked closely at Coles, so that's just a general comment about the supermarket business in general, and as to the benefits of Coles versus Woolworths, I'm not sure.
Okay. We've got such a good variety of questions here today, Alan, because the next one's about income protection insurance. And Paul says, is it best to pay it via an SMSF or not? I'm 51. I'm currently self-employed. I started an SMSF last year and recently renewed my income protection insurance. However, I got mixed messages from the provider, being the agent, that it would be more expensive, plus potentially more difficult to receive a payment if a claim was made. That in the past, my industry fund deducted monthly payments for income protection insurance. So why is this any difference, and what are the best tax benefit options? Okay, so a few questions there. But look, Paul, all industry experts will firstly recommend holding income protection outside of your SMSF, because unless you satisfy a condition of release, you can't actually access it if you need it. So that's if, you know, unless you're retired, you can't access the money. And at the age of 51, you're still a fair way off that. So, you know, that wouldn't be a prudent move for you. Another benefit of paying it personally is that you basically, it's tax deductible, so you can claim the tax deduction up to your marginal tax rate. So, and obviously there are issues with doing that within an SMSF. But I've asked our insurance experts about whether you'd benefit holding it directly versus inside of an industry or an APRA fund, and they have said 100% that you get far better benefits if you hold a direct income protection insurance compared with default insurance that you'll get in a fund, which most people aren't aware of, and makes sense if you think about it, because when you're holding it directly, there's so many competitors out there that they need to be able to compete against each other, and the features need to be competitive generally in the market. And where a lot of those special features come in is actually when people make claims, and that's something that, you know, insurance experts are only aware of when you're making a claim, how much you can actually get out of the provider versus what you can get out of an industry fund. So I'd say, in my opinion, the agent is steering you in the right direction, and I'd be going with it directly, which I do personally, I should say.
Olivia, this next question for me is not something I know about, so I'll need to do more research on that and come back at it next week. So you can
go. Okay, we've got another interesting one from Michael, who says, I've completed a small subdivision in my super fund and my daughter and son-in-law would like to purchase a block. I understand the basic rules of no family arrangements or transactions, but is there a way for this to happen legally, or is the best option to withdraw on retirement and then pass it on given I'll retire shortly. Well, I'm pretty sure that your daughter and son-in-law would say draw it from retirement and give it to them. But it is actually possible for them to purchase a block from your super fund, as you can sell an asset from an SMSF to a related party, but it must be done on an arm's length commercial term. So in other words, the block needs to be sold at market value, and you need to have written evidence to support the value of it from an independent source.
This next one's supposed to be from me, but it actually looks like more for you.
Yeah, I can't answer that off the top of my head, Alan.
It's the first time super saver scheme, and I can't either, so we'll just have to move on.
Okay. Joseph says, after winding up an SMSF, how long must the records be kept? So quite simply, they must be kept for 5 years at a very minimum after the wind-up has been finalised.
Colin says, dear Alan, I saw you on the ABC this weekend talking about the subsidy for diesel vehicles. I'm concerned that your information was not correct. I'm a farmer in South Australia. I bought a diesel Hilux ute for this financial year. The subsidy that you referred to is not a subsidy. It is just equipment depreciation brought forward into the first year of purchase. I found the accelerated depreciation very helpful in the purchase of the ute. Well, I think you're answering your own question, Colin. It's not a subsidy, but it's very helpful. And it encourages you, or at least helps you buy a ute. And I was just pointing out that there's a boom in ute sales as a result of the measure that was introduced by the government to allow businesses such as farmers or other businesses, tradies, to bring forward equipment depreciation into the first year. So I don't care what you call it, subsidy or helpful, it is what it is. What else? There's no more for you. There's a few for me here. Mm-hmm. You might be able to answer some of these as well, Olivia. Ian says, as someone with a reasonable portfolio, I'm always interested in the goings-on as addressed by InvestSmart and Eureka pretty much daily. However, at the moment, I see the real elephant in the room that will have a major effect on our stock market as a possible major conflict between China and the US, probably over Taiwan, or even, as reported in Saturday's Weekend Australian, warning of Beijing grey zone threat in Australian waters. Any thoughts? Well, yes, I think that is definitely a risk, and I've written about it a few times as being a risk. But the trouble with risks like this is you don't know what's going to happen. So it's really impossible to anticipate properly. It's a matter for you personally, Ian. If you think that it really is inevitable, then you need to adjust your investment thinking and your portfolio accordingly. It's impossible to know what's going to happen. Maybe China and the US will not come to blows over Taiwan. Maybe China won't invade it. I agree with you. I think it's looking a bit likely. But and even if they do invade Taiwan, maybe the US won't do anything about it. So there is far too many permutations and possibilities to really get too caught up with, it seems to me. What do you think, Olivia?
I think I'm going to choose to remain silent here, Alan.
Take the fifth.
Play the fifth.
Play the fifth. Here's someone getting stuck into me for being mean about financial advisors. Just listened to your Ask Alan episode on the 11th of June. Once again, you bagged the financial advice business. I feel particularly annoyed. I'm a chartered accountant of over 30 years and became an authorised representative on an independent AFSL some 20 years ago to continue to be able to assist my clients with their financial affairs. My motivation was not to sell product. There is no obligation to know your client. There is an obligation to know your client and act in your client's best interest under the law. Do not discard this in your comments. Yes, there are bad eggs in the financial advice industry, as there are in any industry. Maybe you have had a bad experience, hence your negativity. Look, I'm not really on about bad eggs or good eggs. I'm odd about what has been and is changing now. I acknowledge it's changing, but what has been the underlying structure of the industry, which has been about product distribution. And it just seems to me that the laws and the structure of the industry has entirely been, in the past at least, about the distribution of product. And the financial advisors' jobs were to do that task. Now,
100%. And Alan, that their, sorry to interrupt you here, but their remuneration was very closely linked to how well they did in the distribution of those products.
Correct.
And so entirely conflicted, sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
I get fired up on that one as well.
So my complaint about the industry is not so much individual financial advisors, you know, whether there's good or bad eggs and so on, because I acknowledge that, you know, most financial advisors do really care about their clients and are trying to do the right thing, no question about it. My problem is with the structure, the underlying fundamental structure of the industry, which in my view has been bad. And fundamentally conflicted. So look, but I also acknowledge that this is now changing, but too slowly in my view. There you go. Philip says, I recently contributed to the IPO of ACL, which has been underwater ever since. A poor choice, or should I be patient before heading to the door to lick my wounds? I did think it was a reasonably safe area, but obviously the market thinks it was inflated. Well, you're a bit impatient, Philip. I mean, the thing, this is Australian Clinical Labs is the name of the business. It's a pathology business that floated quite recently, I think a few months ago. The shares sold in the IPO at $4. They came on at $3.40 when they first listed, and they're now at $3.60. I mean, yeah, okay, it would have been nice to for the $4 shares to pop up to $5 on listing, but that didn't happen. And yeah, they probably overpriced them. That's kind of, I think it's very difficult for these companies when they float to get the pricing right. But a lot of companies do overprice their float. That may have happened in this case. I just think I don't think you should ever go into a float like that, an IPO, with the expectation you're going to make a stag profit immediately. I think that, you know, IPOs are not the place for speculation, in my view. You should buy shares in it because you like the business, you think it's a decent company, and you'll do well out of it in the long term, and you're quite happy with the price of $4. Now, obviously, you were happy with the price, otherwise you wouldn't have paid $4. So my advice, without knowing much about the company at all, would be to stick with it. Don't head out the door and take a loss. That's terrible. What do you think, Olivia?
Well, I'd say stick with it. Be patient. What did we just say? Time in the market.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. Paul says, Paul's recommending an interview with Remus Caritis from A4N, which stands for Alpha HPA. And I did it, and it was published today. So that's good. Instant gratification, Paul. No sooner do you ask for that interview, but then it's there. Benjamin says, hello, Alan. I was wondering if you can request a meeting with CleanSpace CEO or chairman to discuss the company's performance. Great technology, large TAM. What's a TAM? No idea. TAM, but currently hampered by the vaccine rollout and questions about their future growth. Okay. On the list, and this one's probably worth answering. Hopefully, you might address. This is from Paul. Unfortunately, I missed posing my question to last week's expert on SMSF. Oh, well, maybe this.
I'll try and answer it now. Yep.
I'm sure you're qualified. Like most Australians, I paid very little attention to my superannuation. That was until you posted a link to a new podcast run by a friend of yours, Tony Kynaston, called QAV, Quality and Value. That single link has changed my investment approach for the better. I'm now an active investor and feel in control of investing decisions. My question is about investing my superannuation funds on ASX-listed stocks. What is the best method for investing in shares where the super level is quite low, about $100,000? My aim is to keep management and trade fees as low as possible. Is the best approach an SMSF or through my existing super platform, BT, which charges around 1.5% management fee, even though I am doing the managing? Interesting, because 1.5% of $100,000 is $1,500. Olivia, you can advise me, would it be possible for him to get his superannuation fund, SMSF, managed for less than $1,500?
He could get it managed for $1,500, but probably not for less, no.
What would you charge?
Oh, around 2,000, 2,200.
Yeah. So that's the issue, Paul. The question is, what's it going to cost you in accounting fees, audit fees, and administration to have your SMSF managed? $100,000 is generally regarded as too little to do that separately through an accountant, an auditor, and so on, because it'll usually cost around about $2,000, i.e. 2%. So 1.5% BT is okay, probably.
Yeah, I mean, and look, the main reason you'd see people moving it into an SMSF at that level is that they want to invest in assets that you can't generally get on a platform, such as property, crypto, or alternative assets. So we don't often see it at just for direct shares. Yeah.
And mind you, there are other cheaper ones than BT as well. Like you could do it with Australian Super, I think, for less, about half that price, and you'd be in a walled garden in the sense that you'd have to invest in the list of stocks that they chose. But I think that's the top 300. I think there's a fairly wide variety available to you. But again, as Olivia says, you can't invest in crypto or residential property or something through that method. So there's a few things you need to consider. There we go.
Wow, great questions.
Great questions.
We've covered nearly every area of SMSF this week, almost.
And almost an hour's worth. There you are. Well, thanks very much for your time, Olivia. It's been, as always, wonderful.
My pleasure.
Have a great rest of the week, and I'll look forward to talking to you again in a month.
No problem.
Thanks very much, everybody. Thanks for your company. I remember we'll be doing Ask Alan every month with SMSF coach Olivia Long from Prime Financial Group. Please send in your questions for her via the website. We'll get together next month and answer them. If you've got any questions for me, put them there too, and I'll get to them next week. Remember, our answers are general advice. We don't know anything about you, and so therefore we cannot give you and don't give you personal advice. Thanks very much. That's it for this week. See you next week.